The Senate State and Local Government Committee will come to order. It's Wednesday, March 19th, 2014. We have a very long agenda today, so as usual, we're asking the members to give a short overview of the bill so everyone understands the context and then focus mostly on the sections that are in our jurisdiction. Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, Senate File 2118, this bill provides for the adoption of the Interstate Compact on Educational Opportunity for Military Children, a compact that has been adopted in 46 states since 2008. The children of military families often encounter specific barriers to frequent moves and school district changes across state lines, and this compact is designed to help ease those transition. And the compact was developed by the Council of State Governments, the Department of Defense, National Association, state and federal officials, Department of Education, school administrators, and military families. So this is an initiative of the First Lady, Michelle Obama, and brought to me by the governor's office. I think we can get into a little more specific. I think I have two testifiers. Which one of you are going first? Rick Masters here is the counsel for the Interstate Compact on Educational Opportunity for Military Children. And would we be concentrating on the compact itself? Give us some direction? I mean, this is a big bill, but it would have the state joining the compact, basically, and or the structure on which we do that. Is that?
I think some general comments are fine. What I'm trying to understand is if this is the exact language that's needed for the compact so that we're not really supposed to amend it at all. So you could address that.
Right. Madam Chair, I'm Rick Masters. I'm the General Counsel for the Interstate Commission on Educational Opportunity for Military Children. That's the administrative body that is composed of the 46 member states, and Minnesota would be at the table if the compact is adopted. And you're correct. It is an interstate compact, which is permitted under our federal constitution for states to continue to manage problems on a collective basis as an alternative to federal intervention. And I think, the Senator pointed out, the Department of Defense from day one felt that the state should continue to manage educational issues within the states. But because it involves interstate activity, rather than preempt the states by congressional legislation, the vehicle of an interstate compact was selected. And DOD, as well as the Council of State Governments, with whom I am also affiliated, we're sitting at the table with a number of educational stakeholders that you would expect to be involved in such activities, such as the National School Boards Association, the Association of State Boards of Education, the National Association of Elementary School Principals, National PTA, National Education Association, just to name a few. The compact is designed to deal with the four specific areas where military children who have to move when their parents are deployed encounter on a regular basis, and the determination of what the primary problems have been was determined based on a study commissioned by the Department of Defense that was conducted by the Johns Hopkins University in 2006 that determined that the four areas where military families have problems are with regard to enrollment, eligibility for participation in extracurricular activities, placement and attendance issues, and graduation. And so that's why this compact focuses on those four areas. It simply seeks to authorize the member states to accommodate needs for each of the students who transfer into or out of the member state in these four areas where they encounter these problems. It certainly does not obligate the state to undermine its educational standards, and you do have discretion in most of these areas to determine if the particular accommodation overrides or in some way conflicts with any standard that you believe is important in the state of Minnesota. As you pointed out, Madam Chair, this is an interstate compact, and as such is really a contract between the states. And so while some amendments are possible, it is like any other type of contract agreement. The provisions of it that are adopted need to be sufficiently similar to the agreement and the statutes that have been adopted by the other 46 states so that we can show that there was an intent to enter into the same agreement. So with that said, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Are there any questions for Mr. Masters? It looks like what's under our jurisdiction is actually Section 1. So, Senator Dole, if you want to just describe Section 1 for us.
Here's the bill. Maybe you want to describe that. Madam Chair, I'll, if Mr. Masters can, I'll have him summarize what Section 1 does in terms of a membership with the P20 Education Partnership.
Yeah, what this constitutes, Madam Chair, would be Minnesota's version of what we're referring to as a state council. The purpose here is to have stakeholders at the table from the state of Minnesota that are more aware of and familiar with particular issues within Minnesota that are encountered by these military families. And the bill selects the P20 Education Partnership as fulfilling that requirement, which is permissible under the compact. And it would add some members, which are required under the compact language, but would serve also as the state council to administer the activities of the compact within Minnesota.
Okay. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sir, the P20 education partnership that we're talking about here, you're saying it's in 46 other states already or is being introduced in 46 other states?
No, it's been enacted by 46 states.
Senator Anderson.
Enacted by 46. Thank you, Madam Chair. And the purpose of this is to gather more information about military families and their children. Is that correct?
No. Mr. Masters.
Senator, Madam Chair, the purpose is to not only furnish information that's necessary for these students who are transferring, but to facilitate the accommodation of needs that arise with this population. Military families move between 6 and 9 times during a career, and problems they encounter involve such things as enrollment, where a family is ordered to move on short notice because the Department of Defense has ordered the military member to move, and they have to enroll in a school district perhaps without having official certified records from the previous state. Believe it or not, there are some states where they weren't allowed to enroll without the certified transcript. So the compact tries to remedy that by allowing a photocopy of the transcript to be furnished, after which within 10 days the sending state is required to furnish certified copy as may be required by state law. Similarly, for things like eligibility, let's say you have a student who's a 4.0 grade point average who wants to be a member of the National Honor Society or the Beta Club, and they missed the candlelight induction ceremony in the receiving state because mom and dad had to move at a time that was after that happened. Well, if they're otherwise qualified by their academic achievements, the compact asks that the state will consider allowing them to participate in that extracurricular activity if they would otherwise be qualified to do so. Similarly, we've got issues in the other two areas that the compact attempts to deal with concerning placement and attendance. The compact asks that the receiving state under the compact would accept the decision of the sending state, the state they're moving in from, in terms of what placement should be in order to get the child enrolled. But then it does not prohibit and, in fact, specifically authorizes a receiving state, such as Minnesota, to conduct your own evaluation of the student's progress. And if you decide they ought to be placed differently than they were in the state they came from, you certainly have the right to do that, and that's not being surrendered under the compact. And then finally, with graduation, we ask for consideration of either waiving or giving credit for courses which are similar in nature. If you have an exit exam that is required, we ask that you would consider allowing a substitute exam if they took one in the sending state. If it's if it's not possible for you to do that, the compact does not require Minnesota to lower its standards, but it does ask that you would work with the sending state that they came from to see if they can obtain a diploma there by allowing their credits to count toward a diploma in the sending state.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Dole, this P20 partnership, it looks like the Minnesota Air National Guard, I'm taking it either Army or Air National Guard, involved here. the Adjutant General is going to be appointing people to this partnership. Have you had any dealings with the Guard at all on this particular proposal?
Mr. Chair, I'll allow my other testifier, John McCausland, a CEO of the Air Force Sergeants Association, to answer that.
Mr. McCausland.
Madam Chair and Senator, in most cases, the governor is the one that appoints. Usually, it's the military side, the adjutant general, but not in all cases. So they are familiar with the family situations and disruptions.
Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Senator Dahl, I've not had any contact from Mr. McElhaney or anybody from the military affairs or military regarding this, and so I'm totally out to lunch as far as knowing what and how they feel about it. I'd like to have some testimony from our adjutant general or somebody in the military affairs regarding this.
Introduce yourself.
Please introduce yourself.
Madam Chair, I'm David Leon with the Department of Military Affairs. I'm the Director of Support to Military Operations, and we do support this bill. We are very familiar with the compact, and we feel since it really doesn't impact our Minnesota National Guard members, since they're not an active component, we do strongly believe that it's still an important bill because it allows the active component to kind of transition into civilian life or if they were mobilized to another state. For instance, it would allow them to easy transition into schools, and so we do support this bill.
Mr. McCausland, did you want to make a statement or say anything else?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I am the CEO from the Air Force Sergeants Association based in Washington. Flew in last night. I did 32 years on active duty, three of those in Vietnam, so I am very familiar with families and kids' problems, and my kids went to 17 schools in 32 years. So there is a lot of disruption that goes on. So this is really, for lack of a better word, handshake between states to make sure that we transition these children between schools and they're not, that they're not hosed. We don't want them to be messed over just because mom and dad put their hand in the air. Hmm. Thank you.
And you flew here to get away from the D.C. snow?
Oh, God, I'm going back to it too, Madam Chair.
And Madam Chair, I might add that the question we got in Commerce is why is Minnesota becoming, one of the last states to do this, and we have a very small military in terms of families, number of children that might be affected by this. I think we heard maybe a couple hundred. And so it's maybe hasn't been such an urgent issue, but we still want to join those, make it easier for those few hundred that are affected.
Are there any other questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Peterson.
I'm just curious, where is the compact at in terms of congressional consent? Is it been consented on already?
Or? Well, interestingly, and
Mr. Masters.
Senator, Madam Chair, I have had occasion over the last 20 years to do a lot of research in not only compacts affecting education, but a wide variety of interstate agreements, and I'm a co-author of a book on the subject by the American Bar Association, and one of the principles that is involved in interstate compacts is that congressional consent, while the Constitution seems to suggest all compacts require it, in fact, the Supreme Court of the United States has determined only those compacts that infringe upon some enumerated power under the federal Constitution require congressional consent. So we do not believe that this requires Congress to consent to it.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Anyone else in the audience want to testify? Then, Senator Dahl, this bill has to go to Judiciary Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll move Senate File 2118 be recommended to pass and referred to Judiciary.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you.
The next bill on the agenda is Senator Kent. Welcome to the State and Local Government Committee, Senator Kent.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to present Senate File 2255, a Metropolitan Council agency bill which seeks to provide the council with the same cash management tools as similar government entities have by amending Minnesota statute. As background, presently Minnesota statutes 118A.07, subdivision 1, provides additional investment authority to cities with a population of 200,000 or more, or a county that contains a city of that size. This bill would add the Metropolitan Council to the entities that are allowed this additional investment authority. The council will be subject to the same oversight process that applies to other governmental entities that use this authority. These additional investment authorities will enhance the Met Council's ability to address cash flow volatility and respond to market conditions and opportunities. These tools will strengthen budget certainty. Again, I thank you for the opportunity to bring this bill forward, and I hope you will agree that it makes sense to provide this consistency among government entities, as well as enhance fiscal certainty for this important government entity. Here with me today is Mary Bogey, the Chief Financial Officer for the Metropolitan Council, who will provide more information about this request and answer any questions. Thank you.
Ms. Bogey, did you have any additional comments?
Madam Chair, I will just leave to your questions and provide additional comment that way.
And does this have to go anywhere else? No. Tax committee or anything? No? Okay. And members have any questions?
Madam Chair.
Okay. Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair, Senator Kent, putting this information in changing the statute to include the Met Council includes these counties, how will that affect their budgets and their financial statements?
Madam Chair, if I can let Ms. Bogey
address
that.
Madam Chair and Senator, including the counties in here as well as the Metropolitan Council gives us the ability to use these tools to improve our investment income. So it gives us opportunities in particular in times when it's pretty lean out there in the investment market to use additional tools to improve our investment income.
So, Madam Chair, to the testifier, is this going to allow them to be exempt from certain taxes in the state?
Madam Chair and Senator,
it
does not allow them to be exempt from taxes. We are still required to invest in only those things that the statute allows us to invest in. In some cases, those are tax exempt, and in other cases, they're taxable. In particular, for the Metropolitan Council, when we issue debt, it's tax exempt debt. This is the reverse. We're investing in debt of other municipalities or in corporate debt.
I see that you are to report electronically to the state auditor. And since the state auditor is here, does the state auditor have a position on this? No. All right. Just because she's here in the room. Any other questions?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Any opposition, Madam
Senator
Chair,
Hall?
To this bill?
We don't have anyone who signed up in opposition, and we don't believe so. I haven't heard from anyone. Staff hasn't heard from anyone. Okay, then can we have a motion? Senator Dahl moves that Senate File 2343 be recommended to pass. Goes to the floor.
Senator Kent? It's 2255, just to be
precise. Thank you
precise.
Very much. It's 2255. Oh, I've been looking at the wrong bill. I've been looking at my own bill. let me see. 2255. I don't even have it.
It was way down. It's way down in the stack.
I have the description. Picked up the room. I wonder I was confused. All right. The motion, Senator Dahl made the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. All right. Senator Eaton. Chair. I have the bill up.
I don't know who that is. I'm saying.
Trying to get up.
Okay. Senator Pappas, Senate File 2343.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is a bill requested by the state auditor, so I'm going to let her explain it. Ready? Tennessee Allen, whoever wants to do it.
I can do it.
Please introduce yourself for the record. Thank you.
Rebecca Otto, the state auditor, Madam Chair and members. I'll be brief. So this legislation, Senate File 2343, revolves around local government's ability to put together a trust to invest their assets to pay other post-employment benefits. That wouldn't be pensions. That would be like retiree health care. So law allows for that, and they can either do it with banks and their trust departments, or they can do it through the State Board of Investment. And they've been doing this for a handful of years, and now there's a reporting requirement. Well, they'll be required to report some data into our office. And reviewing the language, we found that the information in SBI, PARA and SBI were reported into us, and then the trust departments of banks. And reviewing what was required to be reported, the information we were going to get would not have been comparable or apples to apples. And so we worked with PARA and State Board of Investment, and State Board of Investment is here today, on language that will make the data reported meaningful. And specifically, they'll be reporting in market value, contribution and withdrawals, annual rates of return, and all investment management and plan administrative costs and fees. And the administrators will have to certify the info when the report is correct, and then they have to certify the rates of return are computed according to specific industry standards, because that wasn't there before. So it's really a great on-session bill, technical, and but we have worked with SBI because they'll be reporting to us as well, and we think it's a really good government bill.
Are there any questions for the auditor?
Other than pensions, yeah.
Ms. Allen?
Madam Chair, then I'll just move that Senate Bill 2343 be recommended to pass.
Senator Pappas moves Senate File 2343 to pass. And where does it go?
Close to the floor.
To the floor. Okay. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion passes.
Bill on the agenda is Senator Bonoff here?
It happens.
All right. Is Senator Jensen here? No. Senator Dibble? Senator Hoffman? We don't have any
Senators here.
Senator Nienau? Senator Herr? I can't believe it. We have to go find some authors.
Secretly, you're with me.
Wow. Oh, indeed.
We're just going to.
Doesn't bode well for getting through.
Secretly, you can say.
Somebody sending for somebody?
Yeah.
Senator Jensen is on her way,
okay.
I've been told.
We're calling me now because she asked for a phone call.
All right. Well, I'm sure he didn't think we'd get to him that quick.
Nope.
What do you think?
There she is.
Great. And Senator Bonoff is here as well.
Oh,
so that's fine. Yeah, Senator Jensen. All right, you guys want to fight over it? Senator Bonoff.
She was gracious. Thank
Sorry.
You.
Senator Bonoff wasn't here, so I sent for Senator Jensen. I think Senator Bonoff is, we're going to be quick, right?
Yeah, we have two bills. And I just had a bill up another committee, so thank you. And I would like my testifier to join me, Randy Maluchik.
This is 2001?
Thank you, Commissioner. Yes, 2001. Right. So this is, whenever we do things for veterans, it's always an honor to even present the bill. So this bill is very simple. It offers in-state tuition to all veterans who choose to attend college in Minnesota. And 2 days ago, we had our Veterans Day on the Hill. We all got to hear from our veterans and honor them and so appreciate them. When I first planned to offer this bill, I learned that MNSCU actually goes beyond what this bill does currently. MNSCU offers in-state tuition to family members as well. And so in our at our first stop, we added an amendment to the bill that says not, you know, that institutions should continue to do what they're currently doing, but this is really a floor. And the University of Minnesota also already did this, but not for its graduate students. So this just makes sure that every veteran who has been honorably discharged gets the in-state tuition. President Obama just yesterday, which is also in your packet, offered medals of honor to 25 well-deserving, some, in fact, who have passed away. And this was a situation where they went back over records of those who had served in World War II, Korea, and
Vietnam.
And Vietnam, thank you, and looked at their service, and particularly the those who were Latino and those who were Jewish, because those were groups where they, in some cases, didn't qualify for the highest award because of prejudice. And then they added other subgroups in as well, and so those were those awards. So it's just, it's always an honor, as I said, to do something that makes sure we welcome our veterans and we do everything we can for their reentry.
Ms. Chair,
Maluchnik.
Maluchnik.
Yes, Commissioner Maluchnik.
Commissioner.
Carver County Commissioner. Yes, ma'am. Well, I was 12 years old before I could pronounce it, so you're doing quite well, Madam Chair. Just the nomenclature here, I spent 8 years as a recruiting retention NCO in the Army National Guard on a full-time effort. Part-time, I was a retention NCO before that. 8 years as a veterans liaison for Congressman Mingy, and 6 years as a veteran service representative of the United States Department of Veterans Affairs. Two things that excite me about this bill is, first of all, it gives us another shot at some of those excellent veterans and improve our workforce here in Minnesota, where they're on active duty or just getting off active duty, and see some great programs that are offered by our post-secondary institutions and say, well, you know, I might be able to afford to come here and do that, and they might stay. And if they don't stay, then they become great ambassadors for Minnesota and also for, of course, their institution of higher learning. Particularly close to my heart is reducing the stress and financial situations that our veterans who are particularly somehow combat-related or somehow threatened in the theater of where they're serving. You know, that when they come back, they're no longer covered under the Soldiers and Sailors Act, so they have the financial obligations piled back on. In some cases, they come back, and I think it's a six-month situation, but they're already back into student loans and those kinds of things. So anytime that you can do anything that might help them out financially during the readjustment period, that's a good thing. And we're all concerned about the high suicide rates, of course, that's going on with our returning veterans. So those are the two things that I think are important, Madam Chair. And if anybody has any questions, I sure have plenty of war stories about individuals and how we helped them and worked with them and how they went through these situations. So.
So, Senator Bonoff, this is regardless of where their previous residence
exactly.
was before they served.
Right.
If they moved to Minnesota, we accept them as residents.
Yes.
Immediately.
And there's no year waiting period.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Any questions about this bill? Anybody else in the audience who wants to testify? Does this have to go anywhere else?
Madam Chair?
No. Anyone who makes the motion? Senator Anderson?
Madam Chair, to Mr. Maluchnik, do you have any idea how many people are going to take advantage of this opportunity if once it gets becomes in statute?
Commissioner Maluchnik.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, I absolutely have no idea, and it'd be a swag, and that's the second time I've been asked that question in 40 years, and first time was in Wyoming when I was a National Guardsman and trying to get tuition assistance. So I can't. I would be the wrong person to ask that. I would recommend you contact the Commissioner of Veterans Affairs Office, and they can give you an educated guess on that, sir.
Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've got a daughter that's a year and a half away from having 20 years in the Air Force, and she's not coming back to the state. She said, why should I give my check back to the state of Minnesota in taxes when I can go someplace else and not have to have it taxed, that I can get an education from someplace else and not have to have it taxed. So I'm just concerned that we're doing something here, small something, and we're not doing something else to encourage their financial status being taken care of, too, as far as their military retirement. So I appreciate the baby step. Maybe there will be some more.
And Senator Anderson, speaking for myself, if other people have other ideas on how we can assist veterans, we should, you know, perfectly willing to hear them and,
I agree.
You know, try to pass them, whatever we can do. Is there someone here from Veterans Affairs that may know if there's an estimate on how many people? We don't really know.
Madam Chair, we did consult with Veterans Affairs, and yesterday we had the Minsky folks and the university folks, but nobody asked the question. So you know, they were supportive of the bill, but we didn't ask that question.
Well, we haven't had a request from the Finance Committee to see this bill to see if there's an impact at all. So it's probably minimus. Is that the word? Anyone else want to testify? Someone want to ask for the motion? Senator Scalzi moves that Senate File 2001 be recommended to pass and to the floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Thank you very much, Commissioner.
Yes, thank you, Chair.
Senator Bonner, if you have another bill?
I do, Madam Chair, but I'd be willing. Oh, yeah. I was very good. My testifier. Yes.
Okay.
So that'd be great.
And if you want to just give us just a short summary of what you're attempting to accomplish here, and then we will look at our jurisdiction would be the impact on local government, right, and the adoption of rules. Just the rules. Okay, just the adoption of rules.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I do have the A-10 amendment.
Okay.
Which does pertain to the rules.
Okay, well, why don't we hear about the bill first,
okay,
and then we'll take the amendment.
Okay, very good.
You might want to explain the amendment while you explain the bill.
Okay. Last session, we adopted legislation to allow for a pilot project during the 2013 election, and that pilot project was to test the e-poll book, the use of e-poll book rosters in our polling places in a few different locales. I'm here joined by David Maeda from Minnetonka because Minnetonka has actually been doing this for quite some time. What this bill does is it now says that local jurisdictions may use e-poll books and follow guidelines set forth within this bill. At our last, we had discussed in our task force of actually having a second study done where more people would experiment with it, and it was determined that we really had all the information we needed, and so this bill is now simply permissive to allow these local jurisdictions to decide on their own. And it's funny, yesterday legislation was passed in Illinois offering the very same thing. So this is happening all over the country. It's important that we keep up with what technology avails us, and the A-10 amendment is simply to do expedited rulemaking because the way the bill was written when there was a study is then the remaining laws didn't go into effect till 2015. Because we removed the study, everything became available in 2014, and so there needed to be expediting rulemaking only around the testing of the e-poll book equipment.
And what are you doing on page 4? Delete line 2 and insert. Okay. Ms. Dangle.
Thank you, Chair Pappas. This is a technical formatting and correcting a cross-reference requested by the revisor's office.
Okay. Any questions on the amendment? Someone want to offer the amendment? Senator Torres Ray moves the A-10 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Did you want to make any comments, Mr. Mida?
I'll just make a few brief comments. My name is David Maeda. I'm the city clerk of Minnetonka. As Senator Urbano said, we've been using electronic poll books in Minnetonka on a limited basis since 2009. I think this bill takes the next logical step forward to getting it implemented in other communities as well. One of the hurdles that we're now facing is, as we have done pilots, the vendors are unwilling to modify their products that we're using, make them specifically for use in Minnesota. Because if we're not an actual customer of the vendor, they're not going to spend the time and the money it takes to, and specifically for Election Day registration, modify their software so we can do what we need to do in Minnesota. What this bill does is it really allows us, sets the minimum criteria of the software we'll be using, and then for jurisdictions, and hopefully it'll be more than just Minnetonka, we'll select a vendor, we'll get their software to where we need it to be actually use it in full elections in Minnesota. And I think once we take that step, it's going to be more common that other communities will want to use the software. I'll conclude my testimony. The President Obama established a commission after the 2012 election to look at election administration issues. It was a bipartisan commission. He appointed his campaign manager and Mitt Romney's campaign manager to co-chair. One of the recommendations of that task force was for jurisdictions to start using poll books to improve their processes. Another recommendation, which I think gets to what we're trying to do in Minnesota, is to look to the private sector to start implementing some of the things they have done to reduce lines in situations where lines are normal. And the best example I can give on a simple way electronic poll books can improve Minnesota's processes is currently if you go into your polling place, you have to get into the right line. You have to get into the line based on what your last name is. You have to get into the right line whether you're a registered voter or non-registered voter and have to register. What Publix will allow us to do is be like a bank where we have one line and you go to the next election judge available and that person can assist you in checking in no matter what your status is. This isn't exactly modernizing elections. This is a 1980s process, but by using electronic Publix, we can now do that. And with that, I'll conclude my testimony.
Are there any other questions?
Madam Chair, I just wanted to also let members know that I served on that e-poll books task force as well as Senator Kiffmeyer did. And so the two of us were, along with Mr. Maeda, were the members of the task force who didn't think a study was necessary, who thought this was the right direction. And so I've been working closely with Senator Kiffmeyer each step of the way.
Okay. Senator Torres Ray, then moves that Senate Bill 1811 as amended be recommended to pass. That's it. Goes to finance. Good. I need to check. Usually I have it written down. I don't today. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay. Motion prevails. Thank you.
Madam Chair, is that supposed to be as amended?
Didn't I say as amended?
Yeah, you did.
I did. I meant to say as amended. Oh, there it is. All right, thanks. Senator Jensen, that happened to me earlier as I rushed to a committee meeting. They were waiting for me, and somebody else also had just rushed in.
All in the spirit of getting things done, Madam Chair.
Right.
Thank you.
Senator Jensen, welcome.
I'm here today to talk about Senate File 2372. It is the Insurance Fraud Prevention Act. It's the work of several legislators. There were 11 that served on a working group over the interim, along with over 70 members, interested people involved, that got together. And actually, we created a report that was presented to the Commerce Committee, the Senate Commerce Committee, on March 12th, and it had 11 recommendations in it. Senate File 2372 contains several of those recommendations. I'm not sure, Madam Chair, if there's a scope that you would like
Senator Jensen, we are mostly interested that. Thank you for that overview. We are specifically interested in Section 12, which is the task force. And 14, and on page, what page is that? Also on page 4, lines 4.5, 415, and 416. Those are our two areas. Why don't we start with what page was it? Page 4. Mm-hmm. Why don't we start with page 4?
Sure. That lines particular section.
415, 416, hearings under this section must be conducted in accordance with Chapter 14 and any other applicable law. Mm-hmm. And Ms. James, do you want to just tell us what Chapter 14 is?
Madam Chair and members, Chapter 14 is the Administrative Procedures Act.
that's what that is, and there's no questions on that. Then let's turn to Section 10. And Ms. James, does this meet all of our guidelines, this task force?
Madam Chair and members, Section 12, the task force on page 8 and on to page 9, meets the guidelines for a legislation that establishes a new task force.
Madam Chair, I can explain what the task force is.
Go ahead. Why don't you explain what the task force is?
During our meetings dealing with insurance fraud, one of the topics that came up most often was no-fault insurance. And in order for the no-fault insurance program to work, we need everyone to have insurance. So there has been debate in the state on how we make that happen, and there have been a lot of changes that have taken place in regards to whether or not how we're going to monitor if people have proof of insurance. So what this task force would do and be tasked with is to take a look at that broadly and overall, especially now since there is a new computer system that is being put into place in the Department of Public Safety, and we felt as a working group that it would be a great time to incorporate what we felt as a state we should do to monitor insurance verification and incorporate into the technology that's being put into place. So this task force would meet those recommendations and make sure that once we decide if we want to do that, that we can also make it work within the technology that's coming on board.
Okay, is there anyone who'd like to testify on the task force? Are there any questions from members of the committee?
Madam Chair.
Who said Madam Chair? Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Jensen, so just to be clear, the goal of the task force is to come up with ways to verify that everybody in Minnesota has insurance?
Well, it would be, I'm sorry,
Senator
Madam
Jensen.
Chair and Senator Peterson, what it would do is evaluate programs in other states, determine how they're doing this and identify those programs, compare program costs, basically do on consider implementation thing considerations. So it does have a broad task in front of it.
Sam Peterson.
Just a comment, Madam Chair, and this is actually the case with a lot of task forces, is they're created and they're inevitably, the goal is to come up with something, anything, to meet the goal of whatever the reason for its creation in the first place is. I don't think that the language in 8.10 in particular, creating a task force that's mandated to create and fund a program, to me is sort of a predestined outcome of whatever if you're going to look into the issue, there should be sort of a recognition that maybe the outcome shouldn't be predestined. But that's just my comment, and I don't expect any further conversation on that. But
Madam Chair?
Senator Jensen.
Senator, it's to come up with recommended legislation, the legislation that they recommend would create and fund the program.
Right.
That would verify insurance coverage.
That's correct.
Right.
So your point, Senator Peterson, is that there's already an assumption here that we want a program to verify insurance
that we're going
coverage.
To. The task force isn't charged with determining whether one's needed, but rather creating one and debating about the manner in which it's going to be created. Yeah, that's my point.
Do you feel, Senator Jensen, that through the work of the working group, that you already did, determine that there was a need for this? Because this is kind of a two-step process.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Just from hearing it in Commerce, I just was wondering if that was the case. Yeah. Any other questions or comments?
I move the bill.
The Senator Torres-Ray moves that Senate Bill 2372 be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on Judiciary. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay.
No.
Motion prevails.
Madam Chair.
Thank you,
Chair.
Senator Jensen. Senator Johnson.
I should have asked this earlier, but do all task forces now have sunset dates?
Madam Chair and members, we try to encourage people to include a sunset date. They don't all choose to do so, but
that's good. That's good. I think it's great.
Did this one have a sunset date?
Yes.
Senator Dibble.
Jensen.
Senator Dibble, in our committee, we ask people to stick to our jurisdiction, which is a task force, and that's what you have here is a task force.
Yes.
So you're
the
definitely
entirety of my bill, Madam Chair.
In our jurisdiction.
Yes, this is my first hearing on this matter. It's Senate File 2435.
Oh.
Madam Chair, I think I have an amendment.
You didn't go to judiciary first? It got changed to us?
Yeah, it was an attempt to figure out how to beat deadlines. I don't know if we're going to succeed, but we are going to judiciary on Friday.
Okay.
But then we have ag. I know we're trying to figure it out, but
this is
we're
one
trying.
Of those.
You know, you never say die in this place. So.
Senator Dibble, was this one of those floor amendments where you moved it from judiciary to here?
Yes.
Okay. And there is an amendment, you said?
It's a simple amendment.
It strikes
one of the
right,
members of the task force.
Then if someone wants to move the author's amendment. Senator Torres Ray moves the A1 author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay. Motion prevails. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam President and members. What Senate File 2435 seeks to accomplish is to pull a group of folks together to have a conversation over the coming year or so around how best to improve the ability of the whole kind of criminal justice law enforcement community to respond to the extraordinary cases of animal cruelty and neglect that we see crop up from time to time. I think, Madam Chair and members, I just saw one a day or two ago in southern Minnesota. A farm had, a bunch of cows in this instance. We often hear about a whole bunch of horses that have been neglected, not fed. Sometimes we see other kinds of animals. And it really creates a huge set of problems for law enforcement, all the way from the initial response to these incidents, how best to take control of the whole situation, what to do with these animals, for a period of time. That's very expensive as well, so it's kind of hard for local jurisdictions to respond to these incidents when they crop up. There are best practices around investigation that a lot of law enforcement agencies have expressed a desire to have the benefit of learning some simple items, how best to document the evidence, how best to take pictures of the animals, et cetera. And the prosecution community has also expressed some interest in knowing better what the laws are that already exist around these issues and how best to make use of good investigations to prosecute. And also there's a real desire to understand what is the complex dynamic around these matters when they crop up in our community, why they're important to respond to. There's larger implications around the connection to violence in our community. And there are certainly steps that communities can take to detect, to do early detection, to prevent, et cetera. This conversation has been around for a couple of years. This bill started off as a really big bill trying to solve all these problems in the context of a legislative proposal. And we pretty quickly decided it's probably best to take a pause, take a breath, step back, get the law enforcement community together, along with folks who have some interest in these issues. I know that Animal Ag would like a seat at the table. We have an opportunity for that in the five folks who are appointed by the governor to have a conversation, come up with a set of recommendations and bring them forward at some point in the future. We have a few folks who are able to testify quickly, Madam Chair.
Okay, that's fine. Should I just call? Do you have an order? Or
no, you can just call them up according to
Mr. Steele from St. Louis County Sheriff's Office. And why don't we also bring up Dr. Julie Wilson from the Board of Veterinary Medicine. Mr. Steele, welcome.
Madam Chair, Committee. My name is Mark Steele. I am a Deputy Sheriff Investigator assigned to the Criminal Investigations Division of the St. Louis County Sheriff's Department for the past 12 years.
Mr. Steele, I think you have to speak up a little bit.
Sorry. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm a deputy sheriff investigator with the St. Louis County Sheriff's Department, assigned to the Criminal Investigation Division for the last 12 years. I have investigated many animal cruelty complaints. I've also testified at trial in these types of cases. Dealing with animal cruelty cases, I've worked with animal shelters, veterinarians, social workers, and a lot of other people. I would like to give you one very brief example of why I believe a law enforcement task force on animal cruelty is needed. September 2011, we investigated an animal neglect hoarding case on the Ash River Trail, which is located about 20 miles from the Canadian border. There were previous calls for welfare checks on the resident that lived there, as well as animal neglect calls. At the scene, we found multiple huskies that were severely neglected, many suffering. The conditions were so bad, the animals, two of them had to be humanely euthanized by a veterinarian on scene. Search warrant involved organizing a veterinarian, transportation for the animals, and a facility that could take 32 dogs. Because it's not a metro area, this is very difficult to organize this in a timely fashion. We seized the animals, and after the investigation was complete, criminal charges were issued and competency hearings were scheduled. The court appointed a psychologist who had no training in animal crimes or hoarding. A social worker who also had no training in animal crimes or hoarding was told by the subject that she loved her dogs and didn't believe she did anything wrong. Between the psychologist's findings and the social worker's report, all charges were eventually dismissed, as well as the competency hearings. There was no therapy or rehabilitation ordered. This person is now allowed to accumulate more animals, which will most likely cause suffering to more animals, more stress on that person, as well as additional cost to our agency once we start getting calls there again. This case alone shows the need for education and training for law enforcement to have a basic understanding of animal anti-cruelty and neglect laws so we know what to look for the first time we go there. Prosecutors to be trained in charging decisions and choosing subject experts. Social workers should be trained in animal law and what signs to look for when dealing in these type of cases. As law enforcement, our goal is not to imprison or confine people that commit misdemeanor animal neglect crimes, but rather we want to prevent these crimes before they happen. I support this bill and the creation of the task force. I think now is the time to begin a conversation on how animal anti-cruelty laws are enforced and what resources are needed. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sheriff Steele. Any questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Steele, how many similar type, the example that you gave, how many other, in the 12 years you've worked at this, how many other cases have you been involved with?
Sheriff Steele.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, it would be somewhere in the last 12 years, probably 20 of these cases. Some, not to this degree, but probably three, four cases a year that we get.
Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Long, Mr. Steele, I'm sorry. How many of these cases have not had a definitive end to their, I mean, as far as coming to some kind of a agreement as to whether that person or persons received proper justice or were just, as you said in this last one, were let go on their own cognizance and nothing was done?
Sheriff Steele.
Madam Chair, I would have to say a rough estimate, probably 75%. Do not come to a conclusion, I guess, is because once it gets to a certain point, nobody really seems to know what to do with it or how to act on it. The people that I've dealt with, the prosecutors, social workers, probation, they're willing, but there's a lot of unanswered questions out there, and I think training and education would help in that a lot.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a practical question for Senator Dibble. Nice flair today. That's nice. The task force doesn't look like, I don't see anybody on the task force that is representing an ag interest. And it would seem to me that this subject matter would call for somebody who works with large animal populations like an interest. What was the thought around that, or is that an oversight? Or
Senator Dipple.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Peterson, there are a lot of groups and individuals who work with all kinds of different animal interests. We, of course, have, you know, veterinary medicine here. You know, the animal law resources is named specifically. The focus of the bill, of course, is to get law enforcement folks, for the most part around the table to talk. We thought in item number 12, 2.2, where there are five individuals appointed by the governor, would be a good spot for folks with kind of animal focus to be appointed. You know, we can give direction to the governor that, you know, the governor should take a close look at those seats being filled by folks with a focus on animals of different, you know, of different sorts. That list gets long fast, so we were reluctant to start naming particular types of animal focus interests. So that was the thought.
Senator Peterson, you could always put something including, you know, individuals with experience in
animal agriculture.
Animal agriculture or something. You could always do that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And actually, I'm not the best member to actually make that amendment, and I'll just say that in committee. I just was bringing it up as something to think about as the bill moves forward, and I would imagine that there would be some interest in doing that. And then I guess I have a general comment about the task force in general, which is that, you know, I mean, obviously there's a ton of different criminal acts that can be hard to figure out, and I guess I don't really understand why animal cruelty, being within the purview of law enforcement like so many other things, why animal cruelty deserves a task force and stalking, which can be also very difficult to sort of understand and prosecute, or domestic abuse, you know, and I'm sure there maybe has been, but task forces have, you know, I mean, we could have a task force on every criminal act that exists, and maybe doesn't mean that somebody who maybe questions that the need for a task force is pro-animal cruelty. Of course, that's ridiculous, but I mean, I guess just a general sort of statement about why is animal cruelty particularly different than a host of other issues that you could also have another task force on?
Senator Dipple.
Madam Chair, I don't think it is. I mean, because we're working on animal issues doesn't mean that other issues are not important. Those are important, too.
And we did have a task force on trafficking that really helped to improve the laws and bring people together and determine, you know, what was needed in terms of services. And so I think that was a very useful task force. But you know, I know we did have trouble with stalking laws, and we did have to go back and revamp our laws because they weren't prosecutorable. What's that word? It was difficult to prosecute them. No, you're right. Sometimes you need it, and sometimes you just need to keep working on the laws.
Sure.
Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually have one question for Senator Dibble and one for Sheriff Steele. Is that right?
Yes.
Mr. Steele? All right. Senator, I found this provision in 3.3 for outside funding kind of interesting, allowing the solicitation of funding from private sources. Seems a little bit unusual, and then I would ask questions like, you know, what if one group gave a disproportionately large amount of money? Would they potentially have more influence? Obviously not. It wouldn't be stated that way, but if someone gave a lot of money, for example, could a lobbyist or a lobbying organization or political action committee give money? I just thought this was kind of interesting, and wouldn't you have some concern about the potential, you know, influence issues there?
Senator Dipple.
Thank you, Madam President, Senator Thompson. The only intent of that is to make it clear, and I don't even know if this language is necessary or not, because I think task forces do have the ability to solicit. This would be for 501c3 foundation grants or something like that. And we can confine the language, you know, to that language, you know, for, you know, nonprofit or, you know, whatever 501c3 grant type funding. That's the interest that often happens. I think it's a good thing because to the extent that private sources might be matched with any public sources that we put in for this kind of work, it's leveraging dollars from those kinds of entities that might be interested in seeing this work get done, or just entities that are interested in civic engagement more largely. So that's the only interest. I think it's a good thing. It's a good question. It's a fair question. I appreciate it. It's not the goal or the intent. It really is to allow them, make it clear that they can solicit for grant dollars from nonprofit type interests.
I think we should proceed with the witnesses, unless you had a follow-up, Senator Thompson.
I had a question for the sheriff.
Okay, great. Senator Thompson.
Sheriff, you had alluded to, I think if I understood you correctly, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that the goal would be to try to prevent these problems on the front side.
That's correct.
Which we all agree with. These things never happen. But from a law enforcement perspective, really, until there's some reason to believe that something improper is going on, whether it's animal abuse or any other criminal activity, how do you envision getting people before the problems exist, kind of consistent with how we get warrants and stop and address criminal activity? I don't quite understand that.
Sheriff Steele.
Madam Chair, Senator Thompson, I guess what we try to do is, and what the goal would be, is to, when we get these calls initially, to go to the residents, if it's not a condition where we need to do a search warrant and seize animals, which is something we don't care to do, we like to avoid that. We would like to find what the problems are, what needs to be corrected, talk to the people about it, give them what we've done in the past. We've given them a certain amount of time to correct these problems. We go back out, we check on it to make sure that these problems are corrected, and we've avoided a lot of issues that way.
Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And what you just said makes sense to me, but you've done that without the task force, right? You do that now.
We do that.
Sheriff Steele.
Correct.
Thank you.
And now, Ms. Wilson, Dr. Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, committee members. My name is Dr. Julia Wilson. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Board of Veterinary Medicine, which is one of our health licensing boards, and I'm here today to support Senate File 2435. My office is responsible for licensing veterinarians in Minnesota. In my position in state government, I also facilitate the board's response to complaints against veterinarians and laypersons performing acts considered veterinary medicine, which may also be animal cruelty. I've worked as a large animal veterinarian for 36 years, and I'm quite familiar with animal agriculture as well as smaller companion animals. I bring experience to this task force with animal cruelty cases. Having testified for the prosecution in an animal cruelty case, I've worked with rescue organizations and humane officers. The purpose of Senate File 2435 is to create a law enforcement task force which will allow authorities and citizens to discuss animal cruelty issues and find effective ways to support these authorities in their enforcement of the existing anti-cruelty laws. Veterinarians, as you've just heard, are one of these authorities. Minnesota Statute 343 requires that a veterinarian accompany the peace officer to conduct an investigation of the facts surrounding an alleged violation of the anti-cruelty laws. And Minnesota Statute 346 requires veterinarians to report known or suspected cases of abuse, cruelty, or neglect to the peace officers and humane agents. Failure to comply with these legislative mandates is grounds for discipline of a veterinarian. And yet in Minnesota, our veterinarians are not trained in animal cruelty investigations or evidence collection, and consequently have made errors to the detriment of the prosecution of the case and the animals involved. This deficiency is a major factor in many veterinarians' reluctance to become involved in cruelty investigations. Minnesota does not have a veterinary forensics program. The field of veterinary forensics is in its infancy. However, some excellent instructional tools are emerging through a new program at the University of Florida that would be appropriate for training veterinarians, law enforcement, prosecutors, and humane agents. I support the creation of this law enforcement task force because it provides a means to openly and constructively discuss the subjects I just mentioned and work towards solutions that will support authorities to improve enforcement efforts. We must strengthen the existing legal safety net for animals. The task force created by this bill
is the first step to more effectively enable all persons involved in halting animal cruelty to do their legislative tasks. Also, if I may comment on the question of why, if somebody's already doing it, do we need a task force? The answer is it's not at all uniform throughout the different counties of Minnesota. Thank you.
Any questions for Dr. Wilson? Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair, it says in the bill here that the task force will expire upon the report given. Will that also be the case with the subcommittees that may be established under the task force guidance?
Is that an assumption? I don't know.
Yeah, Madam Chair.
Senator Dipple.
I can't imagine how the subcommittees would continue to exist if the task force itself did not. So the answer is yes.
Okay. We have one more testifier, Mr. Long.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairwoman and committee members. My name is Jim Long, and I'm a community relations officer for the City of Plymouth. And I'm here today on behalf of our chief, Mike Goldstein, with Plymouth, who has represented also the Chief of Police Association in this matter. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today, and I'm seeking your support for Senate File 2435. Chief Goldstein asked that I shared with you the following. In Plymouth, we manage approximately 1,400 animal-related cases each year, and that number is increasing. These cases include missing and found pets, injured animals, and abuse cases. The abuse cases range from pets being locked in vehicles on hot days to animals being chained outdoors in inclement weather with no shelter, abandoned animals, and other intentional forms of cruelty, including a physical abuse resulting in injury or death. And to further exacerbate this issue is the link between animal cruelty and domestic abuse cases. To help address these calls for service, in Plymouth, we use civilian employees, community service officers, or CSOs, who are trained in how to investigate these cases and manage the animals. When the CSOs are not available, our police officers respond, and quite frankly, they do not possess the same training and experience to manage these animal cases. We have had some moderate success with our programming. There are clear inconsistencies within our own organization, but that's exacerbated across the state on how to best manage animal cruelty cases. We know there is a lack of proper training for law enforcement on this issue. We know that there are distinct differences in need between Greater Minnesota and the metropolitan area. And unfortunately, we also know there is little accountability on these investigations. But what we do not know is how to best solve these concerns on a statewide level. And that is where a task force would offer some much-needed direction. My sincere hope is that you will support Senate File 2435 so that this task force can study this important matter and generate best practice for law enforcement. Through this process, a careful exploration can commence and constructive outcomes can be developed that will alleviate the problems and inconsistencies that we currently face when it comes to the investigation of animal cruelty in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Officer Long? Okay. If Senator Dibble was interested, our staff has some language that would clarify Subdivision 5 on line 3. We could do it orally now if I think some of the members brought up some issues around this, or we could prepare the amendment for you to offer in Judiciary Committee. Is there any preference?
Madam Chair, I'm comfortable if members are comfortable without receiving it in written form. Otherwise, I'm comfortable with advancing it in Judiciary.
Oh, Ms. James, why don't you just give the members an idea of how it would read?
Madam Chair and members, this would be an amendment that would be inserted on line 4 of page 3 after the word sources. And this language would just clarify the route of these funds. So after the word sources, insert which are accepted on behalf of the state and constitute donations to the state, period. Funds received under this subdivision are appropriated to the Commissioner of Public Safety for purposes of the task force, period.
For purposes.
Are someone interested in moving that, or should we send? All right, then Senator Dahl moves the language as stated by counsel. Senator Dibble, that you're okay with that?
I'm very comfortable.
All right. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Anyone else in the audience wants to testify? Yes. Please just introduce yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Tom Peterson. I'm the Director of Government Relations of the Minnesota Farmers Union. And I just wanted to echo kind of the path that Senator Peterson was going down. And we're not opposed to the task force. We're just, wondering where we fit in representing farmers in agriculture. And I think there's a way to do it, and we can continue to work with Senator Dibble. But do want to mention, because a lot of agriculture, it's so varied. Our members that milk 10 cows, it's so much different than our members that milk 1,500 cows, raise 100 chickens or 100,000 chickens. We work with law enforcement a lot in different areas because a lot of times they reach out to farmers or our ag organizations to try to develop, and something we've been working on for years. So I do see value in it, but I also am concerned about, if we were to put together a task force theoretically and there is five people and we didn't have five people, we'd still try to be involved in it. But I think there's value in having somebody from, some form of agriculture represented on the task force. So thank you.
Madam Chair, Mr. Peterson and I have spoken previously on this, and I agree that that's a good idea. So do the bill's proponents. Like I said, I think the spot where folks can land and we can condition that language is where the governor has the five appointments. We do need to think carefully, though. A lot of folks interested in animals who are going to have the same arguments. So we have to think carefully about how we do that. But I don't want anyone to feel defensive or panicky about what our goals and intent are. So I think this is a useful communication and conversation to have.
Okay, any more discussion? Then any amendment? Anyone want to make a motion?
So moved.
Senator Hayden moves that Senate File 2435 as amended.
Oh, Madam President, sorry. I did want to call your attention to the testimony from Dakota County Attorney Jim Backstrom.
Yes.
In favor. All right, thank you.
That was just passed out.
Yeah.
Mr. Backstrom is very visible here and comments on a lot of things.
Thank you.
Then may the motion, Senator Hayden, move that Senate File 2435 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on Judiciary, where all bills go. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator.
To Madam Chair, members.
All right. Senator Hoffman, I'm sorry. We called for like three people, and they all arrived at the same time. So we'll just go to our regular order. Sorry, Senator Ninau. You need to get here just 2 seconds sooner. Senator Hoffman, 1722.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, with me at the at the table is John Thorson from Education Minnesota. I want to thank you for the opportunity to present Senate File 1722, the PELRA, Public Employment Labor Relations Act bill. I'm here to talk to you about Senate File 1722. It's a simple bill. It changes state law so that art therapists, music therapists, and audiologists are defined as traditional teachers under the Public Employment Labor Relations Act. Minnesota's definition of teacher has not kept up with the changing workforce in special education specifically. Art therapists, music therapists, and audiologists have all become increasingly important in helping special education services be provided to students and help those students succeed. These educators have 4-year degrees and must follow most of the federal compliance requirements as special education teachers. So I urge you to support Senate File 1722. This is time that we need to change the definition of teacher so that educators have the same access and same salaries and benefits as traditional teachers. Thank you, and now I'll turn it over to Mr. Thorson for some brief comments.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Thorson with Education Minnesota. To echo what Senator Hoffman said, Senate File 1722 extends bargaining rights as teachers to the three job classes of audiologist, art therapist, and music therapist. And statewide, these are folks that critical and becoming more critical to the delivery of special education and high need students. Statewide, I believe we're talking about dozens of individuals employed by school districts, and it's time that these folks, along with past precedent of including occupational therapists and physical therapists into PELRA as teachers for the purposes of bargaining with school districts, that this happens as well.
So they didn't fit in under any other title, so they just weren't included?
Madam Chair, they're not defined as teachers for the purposes of bargaining under PELRA. They're public employees. They're not. This would allow them to bargain with teachers.
To be defined as teachers. Right. I see. Okay. Senator Peterson.
So just to clarify, thank you, Madam Chair. How many estimated employees would be moved into the classification? Again, you said dozens of them.
Madam Chair, Senator Peterson, it's a very small amount. You know, each school district probably has, you know, two to four of each that are specifically on the cooperative side where this issue really came up. The Minnesota River Valley Special Education Cooperative wanted to merge with the Carver Scott Educational Cooperative so that they, got some cooperative folks that would be able to teach, you know, along those. And what they found that they ran into a problem was they had assumed that these folks were already identified as teachers. And Darren Kermes, who is the executive director down there, this brick wall really was a hindrance for them to try to get this merger to happen. And so this would help alleviate that and put them in the role as teachers, which they are. They're providing special education and related services. And as you are aware, under Public Law 94-142, those services are well listed in there. So,
Senator Peterson.
So currently, are these positions within the CBAs of the respective districts, their contracts negotiated within the CBAs?
Madam Chair.
Are they sort of independent of that?
Madam Chair, Senator Peterson, you know, they're not identified under the teachers, so they're not they're not bargaining with the teachers, ranks at that time. And I would assume, and I don't know, John Thorson, if you have any, some of them are mixed SEIU, some of them are associations they belong to.
Mr. Thorson.
Sure. Madam Chair, Senator Peterson. In fact, I think there's Senator Hoffman mentioned that there may be two to four of these in each school district. I think it'd be rare for any school district to have as many as four of these folks. There's a lot of school districts that don't. So these are individuals that in a lot of ways are a community of one within their school district. And so right now, again, they're public employees under PELRA. They're professionals, degreed, working in the classroom. But they do not have an ability to bargain right now with the school district. This law change would allow them to join with the teachers in bargaining, in a current collective bargaining arrangement.
Are there any other questions? Senator Dahl.
Madam Chair, and you know, I can speak for Northfield. We do not, as far as I know, we don't have any art therapists or music therapists. We have, a town of 20,000. I may have an audiologist, and when we were bargaining, sometimes these outliers, we'd have to bargain for them, but they wouldn't have a say. And then we'd have a memorandum of understanding that would put them in maybe a specific category that we bargained for them. But a town of 20,000, I would say we probably don't have any of these folks.
Madam Chair,
and
to go with Senator Dahl, these folks are licensed as the OTs and PTs are. They're licensed through the Minnesota Department of Health. And so this would be an act parallel to that. So just another point to add.
Any other questions? Anyone else in the audience want to testify? Does anyone want to make a motion?
I just have a quick question, Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Peterson.
The I can't let my friend Senator Hoffman go that easy. So what is the current? You said some of these folks are SEIU members. Maybe they right now as an art therapist, music therapist, audiologist. Are they required to be in a union right now? Given the fact that they're not classified as a teacher, and then obviously if they are classified as a teacher, would they be subject to fair share if they do not want to be a full-fledged union member?
Madam Chair,
Senator Thorson. Mr. Thorson.
Senator Peterson. I am unaware of any of these folks being in a bargaining unit in the state right now. So this would be these individuals being included within a teacher's collective bargaining agreement. As Senator Dahl mentioned, there are less formal and maybe memorandum of understanding agreements for these professionals in the classroom right now. But this would essentially give them the same standing as any other member of the teacher's bargaining unit. Which would also afford them the same obligations and rights of every other teacher in the bargaining unit.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Hoffman, are there any of these art therapists, music therapists, or audiologists here to speak on behalf of your bill?
Senator Hoffman.
Madam Chair and Senator Anderson, no, there's we don't have any here. In the interest of time, we wanted to make sure this is real simple to get this under PELRA and really using the definition of the Carver Scout Educational and Minnesota River Valley Service Cooperative. These are folks that provide services to students receiving special education services, and it became a hindrance for the merger to happen. And it was just a little brick in the wall, and it's just simply to allow these to then to become part of the definition of teacher.
Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Hoffman, do you have an example of individuals who are wanting to have this bill as a therapist in music or art or audio? Do you have names written that, I mean, from across the state or?
Absolutely. Madam Chair and Senator Anderson, one huge example that I brought with me today just to highlight is Darren Kermes, who is the executive director of MRFSEC in the Carver Scott Educational Cooperatives, now that it's merged. He was once the compliance. He was the manager of compliance for special education throughout the state of Minnesota, nationally known through that. He specifically said in here, having these licensed audiologists, what it caused, though, was that they discovered that they were not. He assumed that they were teachers, which is kind of interesting. Everybody assumed that. But in this case, the discovery led to confusion and consternation on the part of our staff and administration alike. Having them defined as teachers would have made the merger a lot more seamless for them.
So, Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, this issue came to Education Minnesota from an employer. In terms of looking for ways to address this issue.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Thorson, this is the first I've heard of it. So if there were people in my district or around my district in a different district, I haven't heard anybody asking for it. So.
Sure.
Yeah.
Did you say earlier that these people would formerly have been in a different bargaining unit? And now we're putting them in with the teacher's bargaining unit?
Madam Chair, I misspoke. Some associations exist out there, but there are no Mr. Thorson is correct. I sometimes get the unions messed up, and it's SEIU. They are not bargaining unit members right now.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm unaware of anybody in this position providing this work in a school district in the state that is part of a bargaining unit right now.
Okay, Senator Johnson.
Madam Chair and Senator Hoffman, are these people that work, like they work the regular hours of a teacher all day long, or is it just like once a week coming in or something?
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, as you know, under Public Law 94-142, the unique and individualized needs of a child according to their disability reflect what their services are, right? We know that. That's federal law. It's what drives special education in Minnesota. And these folks would work their typical normal day that they would. But also remember, for those kids receiving early intervention services, Part C, that could be, you know, on their natural environment time, which could be in the morning or it could be at night. Those children that are receiving the Part B 619 services, of course, that's going to be during the preschool time. So it's really going to fit wherever the district's needs are in there. But these are full-time people in most cases.
Hired by?
Yes.
Madam Chair, they are hired by the school
district. Yep. Senator Eaton, I'd like to move the bill. Senator Eaton moves that Senate File 1722 be recommended to pass, and it is sent to the floor. Any more discussion? Anyone else in the audience wish to testify? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay.
No.
Motion prevails.
Madam Chair and members, thank you.
Senator Hoffman, your next bill, Senate File 2402.
Thank you, Madam
and
Chair.
And if you want to just give us a brief overview, and then we're going to be looking at the Section 21, the rulemaking section. And Senator Eaton, would you just chair for a minute?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. There is a brief A5 amendment, I believe, that Senate Ms. James found some language there that needed to be cleaned up, and she's passing those out. Ms. James, if you could just explain why the amendment is necessary.
Ms. James.
Madam Chair, Senator Hoffman and members, this change is just to move part of the language about the rulemaking that's currently in an uncoded section at the end into the coded section earlier so that it will be where it needs to be for future interpretation.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So with that, if I could get somebody to possibly move this this amendment, I would appreciate that.
I'll move that.
Senator Johnson moves the A5 amendment. All those in favor?
Aye.
Those opposed? Amendment passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. The changes proposed in this bill are primary administrative. I'll just give you a brief overview, and then I'll get to the points that are germane, the issues that are germane to this particular body. What the changes are important to the efficient and fair administration of Chapter 10A by the board, the Campaign Finance Board. Broadly speaking, the bill has five goals. To update existing law so that the language conforms to changes made to Chapter 10A in 2013. Number two, to secure timely disposal of amendments to campaign finance reports. Number three, clarifying reports requirement and timelines. Number four is to provide a base for the board to start the development of a web-based campaign finance reporting application. And finally, number five is to clarify board proceedings and rights of parties. I believe the issue that's germane to this committee is the expedited rulemaking procedure. In this, the board would have to have proposed rules out for public notice by 8/1/2014 at the latest in order to meet the 9/30/2014 deadline currently in the bill. I understand that this is tight, but I believe very doable. If the bill is passed and process could begin at the May 6, 2014 board meeting. I believe Gary Goldsmith, executive director, is here and may have comments on the rulemaking.
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Goldsmith, introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Gary Goldsmith, and I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. The board hasn't met since the rulemaking and other changes were added to the bill. But as the administrator for the board, I want to say that I generally support these provisions with a couple of minor reservations that I'd like to work with Senator Hoffman on. The minor reservations relate to Section 6 and 7, which define some additional procedures for the board. And I'm simply concerned that the words used to define those procedures, which refer to a prima facie finding, actually are talking about what other administrative agencies, including the Office of Administrative Hearings, would call a probable cause hearing. And I think that that problem will make rulemaking difficult because we would need to try to use the words of the statute but to implement a concept that's somewhat different from the words. Having said that, I welcome the opportunity to do rulemaking to improve and make clear the due process requirements that should be applied during board investigations and throughout its processes. This is something I've been interested in doing for a long time. The only other comment I have besides wanting to clarify the language in Section 6 and 7 is that I have talked with staff who has experience in rulemaking, and we do feel that the time frame is too tight. The board will need to meet at least three different times during the formal rulemaking at specific times to comply with the rulemaking requirements as to when an agency would have to approve various text. Also, this is going to occur at a time when the revisor's office is usually overwhelmed with post-session work, and the revisor's office, in fact, has to be involved to draft, to actually put the rules into the proper format. So my only request with that would be that the date be changed from September 30th to December 30th for completion of the rulemaking, which would still allow the rules to be completed and published before the next legislative session.
And Senator Hoffman, did you want to change that deadline date on 12/32?
Yeah, Madam Chair. Yeah, I mean, originally we thought that the rulemaking would be okay, and I was all prepared to maybe look at October, but that's fine. If it doesn't stop the normal everyday occurrences that are happening at the board, I would be fine with that change.
What was the suggested change?
November 30th or December?
Requested change.
December 30th. Madam Chair, yep. Mr. Goldberg, yep. Goldsmith's December 30th.
December 30th or December 31st? 31 days in December. We don't want to have to be doing anything on New Year's Eve. Right?
Yeah, okay. That's right. I meant that to be that way.
Does someone want to move that amendment? Senator Wicklund moves on line 12.32 to delete September and insert December. Is that correct? Okay. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Is there any more discussion? Okay, then this also goes to Judiciary. Is there a motion? Senator Johnson moves that Senate File 2402 is amended, be recommended to pass, and sent to the Committee on Judiciary. Any more questions? Anyone else in the audience want to testify? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Madam Chair and members, thank you very much. Enjoy your evening.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. Senator Nienau.
Madam Chair, thank you.
Members. Senator Nienau, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, where's the member's jacket?
Is it required in committee?
No, it's not, Madam Chair. I know the rules. Senate File 2036. See, look what you're making me do here. This is a very straightforward bill. It has to do with the City North Branch and their Municipal Power and Light. North Branch Municipal Power and Light has generated electricity for 1,000 customers, up to 1,000 customers, since 1941. And in 1995, it started purchasing electricity for 1,120 customers from Southern Minnesota Municipal Power Agency. It has a three-member utility commission, as is required in state law. The problem with that, Madam Chair, is if any two of them get together, they constitute a quorum. So they cannot have coffee. They arguably can't even go to the same event or meeting. So the city contacted me, and I don't know if this hasn't been a problem until recently. They've been operating for a long time, but maybe there's a couple of board members that have business relationships. I'm not sure, but they contacted me and said this is causing a problem, and they would like the ability to have a 5 or a 7-member board so they don't have this quorum problem when any two members of the board get together. So the legislation simply is a notwithstanding clause and would allow the city by city ordinance to provide for a commission up to 7 members.
Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And I'm not talking about this bill, but this brings up the same issue. I've been approached by some township officials who have 3 people on their board, and they feel that they're running afoul of the open meeting law if 2 of them are in one place at one time. And my advice
your amendment.
Well, no. My advice to them was, as long as they didn't talk about town business, I think they can be at the same location. But I could be wrong on that. But I'm curious how that would relate in the same manner as what you're asking for here.
Are you familiar with open meeting law? Okay, go ahead. Ms. Stengel.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Scalzi. I think it is an issue.
Mic a little close, straight there.
I think it is an issue that a lot of local governments struggle with, and perhaps even if they're not breaking the letter of the law by 2 of them being together, there certainly is a public perception that nobody knows what they're doing when they ride in their car together. So how do we know that they're not violating the open meeting law? So I think it is something that people struggle with.
Any other questions? Senator Nienau, you didn't have any testifiers.
Madam President and Madam Chair, The city administrator wanted to come down and kind of give that personal face to the challenge and give some specific examples, but she was unable to make it here this afternoon.
All right. Is there a motion?
So moved.
Senator Anderson moves that Senate Bill 2036 be recommended to pass. It goes directly to the floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Members, Madam Chair, thank you very much for your time.
Really, the city has to decide to do this. So, Senator Herr, Senate Bill 2166 came in just at the right time.
Yes. Thank you. I've peeked in a few times. Yep, it is the right time now. And, thank you very much, Madam Chair and committee members. Since serving in the Senate, I have the opportunity to be attuned to issue of the St. Paul Port Authority and learn more about the work that they do. And to my surprise, I discovered that our state policy limits the organization from using telephone conferencing for its board meetings. Therefore, I introduced this bill, Senate 2166, to allow its board members to participate in meeting via telephone and use other electronic equipment if necessary. The St. Paul Port Authority's board members are very dedicated to their organization and are active participants, but there are times when some members are traveling away for business, and when that happens, we would like for them to be able to connect to the board meeting by telephone. The St. Paul Port Authority has been effective in job creation and redevelopment in our state and local government because of the direction set by its board members. So I ask Madam Chair and committee members to grant them this usage of telephone conferencing by supporting Senate File 2166. Ms. Lauder and I, Ms. Lauder of St. Paul Port Authority, and I will be happy to answer any question that you may have.
Are there any questions? Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair, Senator Herr, in the bill it says, or other electronic means. Can you give us an example of what other electronic means you're talking about there? You just mentioned telephone, Skype. So no. But the bill says electronic.
Other electronic means could be Skype, you know, or web, or, you know, sometimes cell phone can easily be used as telephone conferencing as well.
Ms. Lauder, did you want to add anything?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. No, I think Senator Herr said it all. I'd be happy to stand for any questions anybody may have.
Are there any questions? Is there anyone from the audience who wants to testify? Someone want to make a motion?
So moved.
Senator Hayden moves that Senate File 2166 be recommended to pass and to the Senate floor. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Herr.
Thank you. Thank
Senator
you,
Madam
Chair. Senator Anderson, for a good question. Thank
there's
you.
Like, there's like 50 of these. We need to just change. Yeah. For everybody. Let everybody do. I've seen this before. I swear.
That's already done. Senator Senjum, we are going to take a break at 5:15, so we have about 20 minutes for your issue if you want to come to the table. Senator Senjum, welcome
Madam Chair
to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee. Pleasure to be here today and I'm with representatives of Dodge County, and this is and I'll just be really, really brief. This is a legislative request from Dodge County to withdraw from the Southeast Minnesota Multi-County Housing and Redevelopment Authority. This has been something I know that has been on their mind as long as I've been at the state capitol, and it's important to them. They bring it to you today, and I will just turn it over to both of my testifiers. I'm not sure who wants to go first.
Thank you.
Mr. Rodney Peterson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'm Rod Peterson. I'm the chair of the Dodge County Commissioners Committee. Also have with me our administrator, and also from the city of Dodge Center, I've got Amy Van Ram, and from the city of Casson, got Mike Martin behind me. I'm just going to read a statement. I'm an attorney by trade, so otherwise I'll just talk, ramble for way too long for you. Excuse me. Dodge County appreciates the opportunity to have this time to demonstrate our support for Senate File 1872, allowing for Dodge County's exclusion from the Southeast Minnesota Multi-County Housing and Redevelopment Authority, known as SHMTRA. This issue being presented today dates back to the mid-1990s when Dodge County asked to be removed from the authority on two occasions in 1994 and again in 2000, citing it no longer wanted to be a participant in the agency. The practice of requesting Dodge removal proved to be futile, as in both cases, the SHMTRA board adopted motions not to dissolve its area of operation in Dodge County. It would not allow for Dodge County withdrawal. While this longstanding dispute preceded my time with Dodge County, it stemmed from the belief that cost efficiencies within SHMTRA were non-existent. A municipal project that was asked for in funding assistance that didn't present a proper case for moving forward, the executive director's persistent advancement of projects requiring subsidies even after county objections, and perceived uncoordinated project management. To this day, you will see after this statement that many of these issues are still of concern to Dodge County. Excuse me. From the onset, Dodge County elected officials determined that it wanted to be removed and find other HRA alternatives for the county to consider in Southeast Minnesota. It should be noted that Dodge County has not contributed financially as a member to SHMTRA, considers itself a member of SHMTRA since 1995, and has not willfully represented itself on the SHMTRA board. However, the SHMTRA executive director has allowed for one representative from West Concord, Minnesota, to represent the county's interest. Even without contributions from Dodge County, SHMTRA has elected to continue to provide services to the county, and was only until 2012 that SHMTRA stated that if we did not contribute after a financial shortfall on their end, it would freeze HUD vouchers within the county. At this point, there are three other formal members to SHMTRA: Winona, Goodhue, and Wabasha counties. There are also contractual members for specific HRA services, which are preliminary HUD voucher-related management. In 2012, two of those counties, along with Dodge, explored the possibility of moving to another agency in Southeast Minnesota for the management of Section 8 vouchers, and were told by SHMTRA's executive director that those vouchers within our individual counties were not the counties, but instead SHMTRA's. There was no choice in the matter of asking for alternatives, as HUD representatives agree the vouchers were SHMTRA's now and not the individual counties moving forward. Dodge requested in 2012-2013 from SHMTRA that, with the understanding the exercise of Dodge County asking for formal withdrawal would be rebuked by SHMTRA. The county asked for mediation between the two parties to settle the longstanding issue. Those efforts were met with little to no response from SHMTRA. In 2013, SHMTRA asked for special legislation requesting taxing authority within Dodge County, which would not be under the auspices of Dodge County Board. None of the board members on SHMTRA are elected officials in Dodge County. Dodge County actively opposed the legislation, as did the other counties in SHMTRA, which begged the question of how special legislation could be sought when defining members of the authority opposing the request in the first place, when all the counties said no. It became clear that to remove itself formally from the agency, Dodge would have to enter into a legal dispute with SHMTRA or seek other alternatives. We chose the latter and asked for Senator Senjum's assistance, as it is believed it would not be in the public interest for what is defined as two public agencies litigating against one another. At this point, Dodge County would request that the current bill be considered, as it offers a clear, definitive opportunity for Dodge to be removed. It defines an avenue for Dodge County to clearly end its relationships with SHMTRA and outlines what terms Dodge must meet moving forward. We thank you for giving us this time today.
Mr. Peterson, are you currently in litigation with SHMTRA?
Madam Chair, the question again?
Are you currently in litigation?
No,
we are
not.
Are you suing each other currently?
Madam Chair, we are not. Okay. We just felt our you know, as you can see, this has been a long time thing. And to me, it's like multi-county county housing redevelopment authority, it's kind of, why do the counties go together anyway? It's kind of we're competing against each other for the same things. And the other thing would be, why would a county want to be in a housing? We want to give that to the cities for the housing. Let our cities manage their housing needs. The county isn't in the business of having housing. So when we're talking about the only other part of this would be the redevelopment, and we've found other avenues that are more effective for the county and do not need this entity to help us in that avenue. So there's no relationship. We've been separated and want to have a formal divorce finally. Irreconcilable differences between our positions is the bottom line.
So do each of these counties that are part of the redevelopment authority contribute financially to the redevelopment authority, and then do each of the counties then have representatives on the redevelopment authority?
Madam Chair, I'll let Mr. Elmquist.
Mr. Elmquist.
Madam Chair, Jim Elmquist, the county administrator for Dodge County. That is correct, and it has been the case since the origination, which I believe was in 1991, that there are contributors to so. Dodge has not been a contributor since, I believe, 1994. There was a payment that was made in 2006 that nobody quite understands the rationale for why that payment was made. It was a payment for approximately $2,000, but otherwise Dodge has not been a contributor to the agency, or the authority, I should say.
You have not been a contributor since when?
1994.
And you still... And
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, and do you have members of your county board that serve on the redevelopment authority?
We do not.
You do not?
We do not. Okay. And that has been since 1994. There was an individual that was appointed in 1994 that Commissioner Peterson alluded to in a statement from West Concord. When Dodge County announced back in 1994 that it wanted to be excluded from the authority, it was with the notion that we would not represent ourselves on the board. That individual was retained by the executive director, who I believe is in the room, and you can ask him a little bit more about that today.
Okay. Did you have anything else you wanted to say, Mr. Elmquist?
I don't.
Okay. Then should I just follow the list here? I have Mike Martin from the city of Payson. And are you Amy Van Rom? Okay, so we can take both of you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Martin. My name is Michael Martin. I'm the Community Development Director for the city of Cassin. We're the largest city in Dodge County, and for at least the past 15 years, we have managed our own housing and redevelopment operations within the city. We've offered assistance to other communities within Dodge County as well. We believe, as Commissioner Peterson stated, this is simply an organization that can best be handled on a local basis. Back in the time when there was no local ability to handle these kind of efforts, a multi-county agency made sense. We believe that it no longer does. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Martin? Then Ms. Van Rom?
Oh,
I'm sorry, Senator.
No, I wanted to ask something when the testimony is finished,
okay.
Please.
Ms. Van Rom.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Amy Van Rom, and I'm from the Dodge Center Housing and Redevelopment Authority. The Dodge Center Housing and Redevelopment Authority strongly supports this bill, as we believe that our citizens would be best served locally. A local HRA can administer the Housing Choice Voucher Program if Simcura was willing to basically hand over the vouchers that they have been issued by HUD. They would need to be willing to do that, though, and it would need to be a cooperative agreement. We have several HRAs in Dodge County. We have the Dodge Center HRA. We also have
Three Rivers
Community Action and Bluff Country HRA, excuse me. So there are other HRAs in our immediate area that would be available and and potentially willing to do that. Citizens of Dodge Center who need housing assistance or a housing voucher, it actually creates a hardship for them because of the location of Semkura. Semkura is in Wabasha, and it's about an hour away from where we are at currently. That's basically how the Dodge Center HRA feels about this. Thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you. Then I have Mr. Wheeler, the Executive Director of Semkura.
Good evening, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Joe Wheeler. I'm with the Southeast Minnesota Multi-County Housing Redevelopment Authority, and we refer to that as SEMTRA. I provided information to this committee. My board just recently, in fact, we just recently got wind of this legislation on Tuesday. Just yesterday that this actually was moving into committee. I had an opportunity to talk to the senator prior to this committee meeting and getting my board to react to it. I originally got a notification of it when I was notified by the Winona County County Administrator that it was on the Winona County Board's agenda to either support and or add their county onto this legislation. They did meet on Tuesday, and Winona County did table the issue to have it looked at legally. I gave you some general information, the last correspondence that we had with Dodge County. You have Dodge County's letter dated on the 12th, I believe. I think it was in July of 2012, and then our response in March of 2013. We have not since heard from Dodge County until we heard about this legislation. SEMTRA Board is asking this committee is to, there are a lot of issues that come along with this change. The Housing Redevelopment Authority is established under Minnesota State statute, and there is a process for Dodge County to follow to come out of it. They did try that. They are correct. They did try that back in 1992. It never got by any of the county boards. It was all tabled because they felt at that time that there was not enough documentation or demonstration for them to pull away. One of the things that I mentioned, the idea of a multi-county HRA, is the efficiencies of it. I can also say that it's not as easy because there is Section 8 rental assistance and also public housing in Dodge County. There's federal government contracts involved with all this, so there are some legal ramifications and questions that still need to be resolved. We have not had a chance to present anything to the Minnesota National Association of Housing and Redevelopment Officials, which we believe would be opposed to this legislation. We have not had an opportunity to talk to the Association of Counties or the League of Cities because I think there's a number of issues here that needs to be addressed, and we most certainly don't want to set a precedence that any county and or city can just come out from an arrangement that affects the lives of many people that we serve. So, again, SEMTRA has been very, very upfront with Dodge County in the past. It will continue to do that. We're just surprised that Dodge County did not make any attempts to notify us of this proposed legislation and not giving, because we would have more people here to testify against this bill today if we would have had adequate time to do so. So we're asking the committee not to move this bill forward.
We're not going to take any action on this today, but Senator Sanjim did ask me to invite the players, the stakeholders, to the meeting so that we could lay some of the issues on the table. Is there a process in current law for Dodge County, as I believe Mr. Wheeler mentioned, that they could, going through that process, withdraw from the authority? I want to know. You said there was, Mr. Wheeler, and I'm wondering, is this Mr. Elmquist?
Correct. Madam Chair, Jim Elmquist, County Administrator. Yes, that is correct on both occasions that Dodge County did pursue that in 94 and 2000. Dodge County followed that process. A public hearing was conducted, and in both occasions, Dodge County elected to move forward with requesting SEMCRA to exclude Dodge County from the authority. On both occasions, SEMCRA elected not to allow Dodge County to be removed. In this occasion, in 2012, there was a resolution that was sent to Mr. Wheeler and SEMCRA, and stating that Dodge County once again wished to be removed. We pursued legislation because we understood that even with the public hearing, and even if Dodge County were to still want to remove itself from the authority, SEMCRA would not allow us to be removed.
Does the law say that SEMCRA has to agree?
No, it does not. And neither do the bylaws of the organization.
Mr. Wheeler.
Madam Chair, again, these are legal questions that are in the statute under 469004 and 469005. Dodge County is correct that they did hold a public hearing. They are correct. We did not formally hold a hearing at that time, but none of the other counties were approached to hold hearings at that time. But Dodge County did hold their hearing. Again, this gets into a lot of discussion. Our SEMCRA's board's feeling is to give us an opportunity to work with Dodge County for 1 year. I can tell you we are getting extremely frustrated with Dodge County. Because they have not financially supported us, and we've done a lot of things in Dodge County, providing the Section 8 rental assistance along with having public housings and working out the legal ramifications of that with HUD and with the county if there are shortfalls, because there have been shortfalls on the federal level, and that's when they had mentioned the $2,000 they contributed. That was the administrative shortfalls to the administer the Section 8 program that we were cut back on a federal level. All the other counties contributed. Dodge County, the other counties did contribute that year. So that's where that those dollars came in. But Dodge County has not financially contributed. We've directly been working with cities. Where we had last left this is since Dodge County will not come to the table with SEMCRA and appoint two commissioners to the board, we requested three cities that have adopted Southeast Minnesota as their housing authority to appoint a commissioner member to our board, and we move on. And we work on the cities that are willing to work with us within the county. That's where we had last left it.
So, Mr. Elmquist, the other entities that are part of the Redevelopment Authority, are there both cities and counties, or is it just counties?
Madam Chair, it is just counties.
Just the other counties?
I should take a step back, because if you look at the formation of the executive board, is not just made up of county officials. I believe the county elected officials make up the minority of the executive board, and there are city representatives, there are neighborhood representatives. So quite honestly, even if you had the other counties in full agreement with you to allow you to be excluded, mm-hmm. elected officials would not necessarily be making that call on behalf of the authority.
Are there any questions from members of the committee? Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Wheeler, have you been dealing with the cities in Dodge County, and have they been contributing to the SEMCRA Redevelopment Authority?
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, yes, we've been working with the City of Hayfield and the City of West Concord. We have worked with the City of Dodge Center as well on different applications. In West Concord, I'll use that as a good one, because it's a very small community of about 1,000 people. We did do a project with the City of West Concord. It was about $15,000, $20,000 to develop that project, which was funded with federal funds, but it took West Concord 5 years on maximum levy that the authority has within West Concord to get that $20,000 back. So, yes, we do that, and we do it directly through individual communities like we have in Hayfield and in West Concord.
Is this Mr. Martin that jumped up?
No, Madam Chair, this is Rod Peterson, the Dodge County
Chair. Oh, Mr. Peterson, sorry.
That's okay. Hayfield has not contributed to SEMCRA in the last few years. I just want to clarify that. So with your question, Senator Anderson, is no. I know Hayfield has not. So
okay.
I just want to clarify that.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Well, I don't really care who runs the program, but I do have a concern with, in the letter here from Mr. Wheeler, that there's could be an effect on the elderly, the disabled, the veterans, and families receiving assistance in Dodge County. And I would like someone to tell me what that would be.
Mr. Wheeler, what was your meaning when you wrote that sentence?
Again, if we have Section 8 rental assistance and public housing within Dodge County. When there was shortfalls, again, in the Section 8 program, which was 2 years ago, and that's what brought this to board, SEMTRA had three counties pay its fair share of those administrative shortfalls, and three counties did not. And with that, the SEMTRA board, again, gets pressure from the three counties that are contributing and want to make sure that their dollars are not paying for the other three counties that are not.
Dodge County are not contributing to SEMTRA?
Pardon?
More counties besides Dodge County are not contributing to SEMTRA?
That's correct. We, Madam Chair, we legally operate in Goodview, Wabasha, Winona, and Dodge counties. Mm-hmm. We operate through contractual arrangements in Houston and Fillmore County to operate the Section 8 program.
If you don't have financial support or physical support from counties, can't you still operate your redevelopment authority working with the cities? I mean, one of the testifiers mentioned they don't feel that's really part of their mission statement is what you're doing, which is maybe why you need the redevelopment authority. Just as why do you want counties to stay in the redevelopment authority if they don't participate?
Madam Chair, if you had an opportunity, I wish I had Goodview, Wabasha, Winona here, but the whole concept of the multi-county is the efficiencies of it. Uh-huh. So it costs the counties less money to have the service available in their county. And that's why. I mean, that's one of the major ones. The move on the federal side, at least that I'm aware of with HUD is actually downsizing. The multifamily has left Minneapolis office, moved to Chicago. They are looking at closing the Minneapolis office down entirely and moving to Chicago. So when they're looking at entities to administer their programs, they're not looking at entities smaller entities and having to deal with multiple contracts. They're looking for a larger entity to do that. Our request to give us 1 year to deal work with Dodge County is we would like to be able to work out how we would deal with public housing that we do have in Dodge County, and maybe there's a contractual arrangement that we could do with Dodge County to operate the Section 8 program and to cover shortfalls. We're not only looking at administrative now as HUD's moving forward or nationally, we may have issues with housing assistance payments as well to be able to maximize it. So there might be some upfronting cash for that program as well. So that's why we have asked for 1 year. I can tell you again that our board is very frustrated with Dodge County. We are looking at other avenues, and that's something that we'll pursue over the next year.
Okay, we're going to lay this bill over. Unfortunately, it's kind of a he said, she said situation. I don't know if we can resolve it here. I think you have to resolve it on a local level, but I mean, I'll have further conversations with Senator Senjum to see if there's some way that we can be of assistance. But we're going to be in recess until the call of the chair.
Madam Chair, can I just conclude? Just briefly.
He used to be here. Yes, Senator Sanchez.
Just briefly.
Hey, you'll be here this evening, right, to take your bill up.
Beg your pardon?
Bill's in HHS this evening, too.
Well, we'll fit you in. You have to be here, too.
Oh, I'm
yeah,
here.
Okay. Senator Sanchez.
No, just to conclude, and thank you, Madam Chair, for this opportunity to if you will, vet the issue. I think it's an important one. It's not like the state of Minnesota succeeding from the union or even Dodge County succeeding from the union, but it is something that local officials, for as long as I've been at the state capitol, really don't want to be involved with anymore down in Dodge County. And it seems to me, generally speaking, I've never heard of anybody, city people here suggesting that what they have doesn't work just fine and they can get along without it. So I understand that we're probably not going anywhere on this year, but it's not going to go away, and more than likely there'll be another year and maybe another time at the table.
Well, and Senator Senjum, we can have more conversations. The session isn't over yet.
Sure.
So I think if we can see some movement to resolve this on the local level, and if we can help in any way, we're